This is Molly Smith, host of From the Median. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Hadley Arkes, the Edward N. Ney Professor of Jurisprudence and a member of the Amherst College faculty. His topic is Taking Stock and Looking Ahead, a Political Strategy for the Pro-Life Movement.
Well, when you get an introduction like that, I wonder who just walked in the room that fits that description. Ladies and gentlemen, you know a person by his mnemonic devices, and for years I had this mnemonic device. I remember when St. Augustine was born in 354 A.D., I recall it was exactly 1,600 years before the last time the Indians won the pennant. But then they ruined it. They won again, 95 and 97. This gathering reminds, we used to have more of these things. It reminds me of gatherings we used to have in Michigan. And I recall one from the late, just think, maybe recall one from the late 70s in Detroit with McCarthy Demers. He's a doctor and plastic surgeon from Memphis. He was General MacArthur's surgeon. And usually there's a youngster, a baby crying with one of these pro-life groups. And there's a baby crying, and when McCarthy heard that, he said, "Ah, the sound of that little one makes me homesick. I've got five back home from age of 17 to 7. But it's that fifth one I worry about, because the statistics show that every fifth child born into this world turns out to be a Chinese communist." Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're here to talk about looking back and looking ahead for the pro-life movement. At the end of June 2000, I was in the courtroom of the Supreme Court as the closely divided court struck down that legislation in Nebraska that barred that grisly procedure of partial birth abortion. That decision was rather jolting, and it was jolting enough to my friends at the National Right to Life group that they finally came behind me in that bill I'd been pushing for several years, which Starr just mentioned, the most modest bill of all to protect the child who survived the abortion. For one notable case in 1977, in Tennessee, a child had survived an abortion, undergone for 21 days, undergone a surgery, died. And the question was put, had there been an obligation to preserve the life of that child? And the answer tendered by Judge Clement Haynsworth was, no, that is not a child protected by the law. That is a fetus marked for termination. In other words, the right to an abortion was the right to an effective abortion or a dead child. The measure I'd been pushing, and which I'd written up for the debating kit of the first George Bush, that measure was designed to break out to the public information that most of the public would find jolting and lay the groundwork for a conversation across the barriers. It was called, in that awful legislative language, the Born Alive Infants Protection Act. Now, most people did not know that under the rulings in Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton, one could have an abortion for virtually any reason through the entire length of the pregnancy and even when the child came out. The so-called live birth abortion. You deliver the child live and put the child in a refuse room to die. Even people who are pro-choice would join us in protecting the child who survived, and that could be the beginning of a conversation. For as we made it clear right away, we'd be raising the question of what was different about that same child 5 minutes earlier, 5 days, 5 weeks, 5 months earlier. Step by step, we would try to convince the other side to come along with us. And if we failed, well, at least from that vast volume of 1.2 million abortions each year, we would have rescued a handful of lives. And for us, we counted that as no trifling matter. The story of that bill, the understanding behind it, the strategy, the travails of moving it through Congress. I led the testimony in the House Judiciary Committee. That story is told in a book of mine called Natural Rights and the Right to Choose, which we had out there. That beautiful book is used by my family all over Chicago as a coaster to put under drinks. But it's out there. We also thought that our position was critical in putting some anchoring premises into place, because during the litigation over partial birth abortion in the states, Judge Richard Posner dissenting from the case in Wisconsin, tweeted us. He said, people never claim the authority to protect the child herself. So why does the state have any compelling interest simply in shifting the killing of the child back from the birth canal to the uterus? Well, in his typically uncharming way, he had a point. Our friends had never put in place that anchoring premise of our own bill that even the child marked for an abortion, they have a claim to the protection of the law. And so we drew upon that line attributed to Andrew Jackson during the Battle of New Orleans, where he supposedly said, "Boys, I want you to elevate them guns a little lower." He said, "Let's take things back to the simplest point. Start planting premises there, and then move forward." And what I'd argue to you today, in looking ahead to elections, especially 2016, is that that simplest of all points gives us the most disarming and irresistible position for a pro-life candidate and party as we look ahead to that critical election of 2016. The pro-life side lost that key case on partial birth abortion back in June 2000 because of the presence of Sandra Day O'Connor. By the time the federal bill on partial birth abortion came to the court in 2007, Sandra O'Connor had been replaced by Sam Alito. And the pro-life side, now fortified by John Roberts and Sam Alito, sustained that federal bill on partial birth abortion. And what I took the court to be saying that day was that we are in business now to keep sustaining a series of discrete measures imposing restrictions on abortions coming from the states, and they have been coming in a good stream. Like last year, we had like 70 statutes of that kind coming from the states. They've been measures on waiting periods of a day, which has had quite a notable effect. Measures on informed consent, giving information on fetal heartbeats, and bills predicated on fetal pain. Some of these measures seem to have taken their model from a bill in the U.S. House to bar abortions after 20 weeks. These have been attended by reports from doctors that we can readily assume that unborn children or fetuses at the gestation of 20 weeks are perfectly capable of feeling pain. It surely was one of those arresting moments during the litigation over partial birth abortion in New York where Judge Richard Casey Conway asked Dr. Anand, an anesthesiologist, "Had you ever thought of administering an anesthetic to that child with the legs dangling from the birth canal?" Gee, no, why would we ever have thought of that? Because a child doesn't count, and the pains of the child don't count. The bills prescribing 20-week abortions at 20 weeks were brought forth to elicit the recognition of the other side that we're not dealing here with a clump of cells, but with small humans who could indeed feel intense pain. The awareness of that kind of pain inflicted on animals has inspired many restrictions on research done to animals. But as it turns out, I've always thought that the number of 20 weeks was a remarkably conservative number. Nearly 30 years ago, some people who remember, the Gipper, Ronald Reagan remarked that fetuses feel pain. And that set off a wave of discussions of late-night television. People were convinced that the Gipper was speaking frontier gibberish. And so they had, and then they had hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee back in 1985, and my friend Dan Robinson made one professor from Yale recede from his claim that the fetus at 12 weeks could not feel pain because, as Robinson pointed out, the receptors of pain did not depend on a highly developed cerebral cortex. The reaction to pain depended, rather, on the most primitive sensory receptors, the kind we associate with reflexive actions, not syllogisms and arguments. Now, I thought myself that these bills on 20 weeks were eminently worth doing, and they had a fair chance of being sustained. But Justice Kennedy had provided the fifth vote to sustain the bill on partial birth abortion, and my reading of him is that he would sustain certain discrete, precise restrictions. It was disappointing for us then, several weeks ago, when the Supreme Court declined to hear that case from Arizona barring abortions at 20 weeks. But that was a telling moment, because it takes only four votes on the Supreme Court to grant certiorari and to hear the case. We have on the court now four solid pro-life votes. But some of our friends on the court were evidently telling us something. One or more of us were telling them us that this legislation was not likely to be sustained. My own surmise was that the situation was seen in this way. One of our friends could imagine that Justice Kennedy would say, well, if the purpose here was to avert fetal pain, well, that could be done by providing an anesthetic. And that could be done without forbidding the abortion itself. And after all, he could argue, we're obliged to tailor laws in the narrowest way when there's a serious chance that they would tread on constitutional rights, as in this case, the constitutional right to abortion. Well, as it turns out, this predicament shows itself on many other bills that offer on their face the most plausible and appealing measures to restrict abortion. The surveys of the public shows that a clear majority, around 62%, would forbidden abortion when there is an awareness of a fetal heartbeat in the womb. But most people don't know how early that fetal heartbeat can be detected. In the mid-80s, when I did my book, First Things, I noted that the heartbeat could be heard with a simple stethoscope at between 18 and 20 weeks. But we knew advances were coming. And now I read that by ultrasound, with vaginal sonogram, the heartbeat can be heard as early as 5 weeks after the last menstrual period, or about 22 days after conception, in other words, at a time when a woman may not even know she's pregnant. But we find here once again the romance of gadgets distracting our judgment. For as I remarked years ago, we would be lured into the fallacy of letting our definition of a human being hinge on the current state of the art in amplifier science. The critical point, so obvious that it's persistently overlooked, is that the advent of a heartbeat cannot mark the beginning of life. The heartbeat comes into being in the course of development of a life already in being, a life that is powering its own development and integrating its own functions and parts as they take form and become more visible. Now, these are all measures worth pressing. They make important points. They may jar certain people who have not thought overly long or deeply on this matter. But they are not likely to generate any tension for the most committed partisans of abortion. For these people have shown levels of shamelessness that allow them to brush away these vexing facts about beings that they're content to see destroyed. Recall Judge Marianne Trump Berry in New Jersey years ago on the bill on partial birth abortion. Donald Trump's sister saying, what are you talking about? A child at the point of birth. The mother decided she didn't want the child. There's no birth. This is postmodernist jurisprudence with a vengeance. Perception is all. We didn't want the baby. There is no baby. There is no abortion. There is no birth. I wouldn't discount then the capacity of the other side to treat all of these pro-life measures as something struck from the ideology of the hard right with its view of the world, and the media will be content mainly to look the other way. Or the media will not be deflected from what it usually seeks to do, which is to foster minor civil war in the pro-life party by persistently asking politicians whether they really want to talk about these issues that most people would rather not talk about, and which the media are quite willing to treat plausibly as a war on women. But there is another approach I want to put before you, another strategy that the party of abortion will not be able to deflect so easily, and the media will find no interest in using for the sake of embarrassing a pro-life candidate and fanning conflicts within the Republican Party. And once again, it's a matter of elevating them guns a little lower. It's a matter of returning to that most disarming measure, less subject to distraction, an issue that brings 80% of the public on our side. And for that reason, it's also the most distressing and politically costly for the pro-abortion party. This is the issue we would have engaged already this past year if the pro-lifers in Congress had shown a certain agility, if they were able to recognize the new moment that was suddenly before us. The moment was supplied by the trial over Kermit Cosnell, the abortionist in Philadelphia, who was indeed engaging in the live birth abortion by killing babies who'd survive the abortion and drawing members of his staff into complicity with his killing. The survey showed about 80% of the public in favor of the prosecution of Gosnell. Many people, of course, were surprised to learn that babies can survive abortions, and that others would think they had a right to kill the child who survived the abortion. In other words, the experience confirmed precisely the effect that we were trying to achieve with the Born Alive Infants Protection Act, to convey this information to the public, the effect that we might have produced if the media had not gone along with the strategy of the Democrats of not giving us an argument and letting the matter be ignored. But now we have the Gosnell case. The muffling of that original bill was so effective that even now people who had supported the Born Alive Act had not noticed the way in which that act could have been brought to bear right now into our politics, especially moving toward 2016. Gosnell was being prosecuted under the homicide laws of Pennsylvania. But what about a federal prosecution? A federal prosecution could have brought even more visibility to the issue and entered into our national politics. But there couldn't be a federal prosecution because the penalties we had originally in the Born Alive Infants Protection Act, civil penalties against the doctors, those penalties were stripped away at the last moment for the sake of averting a veto from President Clinton. It was decided to make the bill an almost pure teaching bill, just plant premises. A case later arose in Morristown, New Jersey, on live birth abortions. The most could be done was a move to withdraw federal funds. We discovered that is a cumbersome and difficult thing to do. We didn't succeed. But with the Gosnell moment now upon us, this was a moment to put even these other interesting bills aside, to recognize the new moment before us, to keep the focus on the matter of killing the survivors of abortion, and do that now by holding hearings on the bill to restore the penalties. Invite the nurses to come in to tell their stories. When we had done that original bill, I was joined by Jill Stanek, a brave nurse in Oak Lawn, Illinois, who's at the Christ Hospital, who blew the whistle on these live birth abortions. And as Jill got on the radio in the aftermath of that bill, nurses were calling in from all over the country saying, "Wow, we've been doing that at our hospital for years." Even we did not realize how often this was done and how many times it was done. And so with the scandal of Dr. Gosnell breaking now through the public, this was a moment at which we could have dropped everything else and introduced the bill to restore the penalties for something that people in this country emphatically thought should be punished, and then invite the nurses to come in to tell their stories. And even if we couldn't enact that bill with a Democratic Senate, the bill would give the occasion for the hearings, and this would be a hard story for the media to refuse to cover. Well, of course, they refused to cover Benghazi, and the hearings over Benghazi. We shouldn't discount their willingness to refuse to cover this one. And yet the problem is sharpened here because the bill would raise a piercing problem for the Democrats, because this is not a matter of inviting new legislation. We have passed this. And this is a return to a bill that Congress passed by voice vote with no congressman or senator, no Democrat in opposition. The Democrats had once agreed that the kinds of acts performed by Dr. Gosnell were reprehensible. They should be forbidden by federal law. And so now here's the question posed to them directly. You voted, all Democrats voted, to condemn this act as a deep wrong. Well, if you were serious when you said it was wrong, what kind of a punishment now will you assign to that deep wrong? Is it at least as serious as a moving violation in traffic? Tell us. We must really put that question to the Democrats and let them reveal to us and the public just how serious they were when they voted to ban this kind of killing. And at the same time, this focus would bring out the fact that the only Democrat of national visibility who opposed that bill at that time was a senator in the state of Illinois named Barack Obama, who managed to kill that bill. And so bringing this up now, it's not merely a delicious sport, but a point of with a serious lesson to put the question of whether the Democrats really stand now with the president they felt obliged to defend. Why should they be spared that question? When it comes to the Republicans, my strategic plan would be to make this quite simple and tightly confined. I'd say, for the people who have trouble talking about this, say, all we want to talk about in 2016 is adding finally those penalties to the Born Alive Infants Protection Act, to hear the stories of the nurses. If that is all we wish to talk about, I don't think the people in the media are going to be running to interview so-called Republican moderates to ask them whether they would detach themselves from the extremism of voting punishments for people who would kill babies born alive. I can't see that happening. It would be slightly harder to paint as extremist a bill punishing what 80% of the country regard as a serious wrong. Now, everyone understands, of course, that this simple measure is part of a larger principled package. If we manage to elect a Congress in control of the pro-life party, there will be a whole train of measures springing from the same core, a whole string of measures served up and enacted. And if this simple strategy helps us elect a pro-life president, we'll have someone there to sign these measures into law. But folded into this argument, I want to suggest today, is a constitutional argument, simple in its own way, but running deep. An argument we sought to make at the time we were enacting the Born Alive Infants Protection Act. It's a simple point, drawn from an understanding running back to Chief Justice John Marshall. And if it had been in place, if it had been understood at the time that Roe versus Wade was handed down, there'd have been no need to have vast throngs coming to Washington every January to seek the overturning of Roe, for there would have been no need even to seek the overruling of Roe, and no need to keep confirming anew the supremacy of the Supreme Court in reshaping our lives and our institutions. This matter is open to us as soon as we raise the question we should raise with anything we do of what's the constitutional ground on which we legislate on this matter, here abortion. We offered another constitutional ground by drawing, as I said, on Chief Justice Marshall in the classic case of Cohen's versus Virginia in 1821. We sought to put this in our bill. Marshall observed there that the judicial power of every well-constituted government must be coextensive with the legislative and must be capable of deciding every judicial question which grows out of the Constitution and the laws. To put it another way, virtually any issue that arose under the Constitution of the law, a Constitution of the laws of the United States, could come within the reach of the federal courts. And yet, even jurists, judges, are surprised by the corollary of that axiom, which is that any issue that comes within the competence of the judicial branch must come, presumptively at least, within the reach of the legislative and executive branches as well. And so we sought to put that in the bill in this way. If the Supreme Court can articulate a new constitutional right, say a right to abortion, and find that right somewhere in the 14th Amendment, the legislative branch, the Congress, must have the authority to vindicate that same right on the same clause in the Constitution where the courts profess to find it, and in filling them out, marking their limits. The one thing that should not be tenable under this Constitution is that the court can articulate new rights and then assign to itself a monopoly of the legislative power in shaping those rights. Okay? We could bring that into play right away when we add penalties to the Born Alive Act. And so we'd have Congress say, whatever the court established in a right to abortion, it could not have meant the right to kill a child who survived an abortion. And once that point is in place, the Congress could move with additional, discrete steps, each drawing, as we know, on wide assent in the public, on the part of many people who call themselves pro-choice. It could be said then, with the ample support of the public, that whatever else the right to abortion meant, it could not have meant the right to kill a child because she might be afflicted with deafness or with Down syndrome or with other disabilities, in the same way that the law could hardly stand by while other people were killed and had their lives ended solely because their lives with disabilities were thought not worth living. What I want to bring home here is what a profound difference it would have made at the time Roe v. Wade was announced if the members of the court had understood that once they'd introduced this new right into our law, they could not have control of it. They could not control working out its shape, its reach, its conditions, the grounds of its restriction. I'd suggest that if the judges were aware of this from the very beginning, that could have given them a strong infusion of sobriety and caution. They would have been even more alert that any novel right they introduced that day, introduced into Congress, would be the source of great convulsion in our politics, a convulsion they could not control. We'd have every reason to suspect that if Congress had been brought into this matter of abortion on that day the right to abortion was announced, Roe v. Wade would have been scaled down instantly to accord with the state of opinion on this matter in the country. The surveys have been remarkably stable here for years, that most people in this country do not think abortion should be performed because of financial strain of the family, because a child would interfere with the education or the prospects of the mother, or because the child is not wanted. Rich Derflinger of the Bishops Committee, tracking these polls for years, pointed out for a long while, 60% of the public would oppose 90% of the abortions that are performed under Roe v. Wade and his companion case of Doe v. Bolton. If the matter were in the hands of Congress from the beginning, there would have been no need to overrule Roe, because Roe would have been scaled down to the state of the law in most places at the time that Roe was decided, which is to say, abortions would be accepted mainly when they are thought to be necessary to that condition, exceedingly rare these days, when the life of the mother could be in danger. I think it could be said, without inflating anything, that if we installed this understanding bound up with the logic of the Constitution, we could gently transform both the legal and the political structure in which the most vexing issues of politics come to us. Starr is going to be leading a demonstration in Washington on March 18th, bringing up the Gosnell case. And this is the moment now to give focus to that move by meeting with our friends on the Hill to say, this is the moment for you to go back and now add the penalties to the Born Alive Act. For many years, we had congressmen proclaiming that they were pro-life, while at the same time they were safely insulated from any expectation that they had the power to do anything about it. I've often used Edmund Burke's line that refined policy is ever the parent of confusion. And so my line to the pro-life party, looking ahead to the elections this year, to 2016, is keep the focus confined and simple. Keep it on the proposal to restore the penalties for killing the children who survived the abortions. This is all we want to talk about this year, the thing most urgent to be done. And from the logic of that bill, and from the constitutional argument that comes along with it, I'm arguing everything else will radiate. And if this simple, disarming bill helps elect a pro-life president in Congress, other good things will follow. But even though we're looking ahead, there is a purpose to be served in getting this bill on the table and in play right away. And part of the purpose is to see just who among this generation of political men and women have at once the nerve and the knack of speaking about this issue in public. Lincoln noted in the turbulent politics of his day that here's this issue of slavery. We're told we cannot talk about it in the churches. It doesn't belong there. We cannot talk about it in politics. It's too unsettling. It's the thing that people most care about. It's the issue that goes to the court, to the core of things, and we can't find any place to talk about it. And here as well, in our own time, we've seen politicians and even ordinary folk who are quite uncomfortable about talking about this issue. We can always count on a band of Republican advisors to advise us to stay away from this issue and not talk about it. But as Lincoln helped us to see, the real task of a statesman is to understand what lies at the core and then use his winning ways and his knack to show people how to talk about it. Back in the mid-90s, this is a side note, I was giving a talk down in North Carolina to a black tie dinner of the English-speaking Union. It was a group largely of conservative executives. And I was speaking about the election of 1996. And I have to say something honestly as to what I regarded as the most central issue in that election. And so I told them that I hadn't said anything that night on the issue of abortion and taken the moment to lay out the substantive argument for them. But I asked them if they could flex their imagination simply in this way. If someone looked out on the scene and saw 1.2 million members of a minority group who could be lynched or killed with the law looking aside and without the need even to render a justification for that killing, where do you think he would place it in the whole range, scale of issues? Would he think it's just above the level of interest rates or the level of unemployment? Would you be surprised if someone looked out and saw the world in that way that he couldn't regard that as a peripheral matter? He would have to regard it as central. I'm inclined now to ask some of our candidates for office, do you think human beings are killed in these abortions you're condemning? Do you think real human beings are killed? I often wanted to ask that of George Bush when he signed our bill, because he told Father Newhouse that, I'm with you on this, but don't expect me to take the lead. If 1.2 members of a minority group would be killed every year, would we not expect the President of the United States or a leading candidate to say something about it and, in fact, to address it? The question of how we talk about this matter and what we're teaching formed the main argument in that book of mine that contained a memoir in part of our work in passing that bill, the Barna Live Infants Protection Act. I'd like to bring this talk to its culmination now by recalling three vignettes from that book carrying the lessons that I was drawing. The first one involved a fine student of mine who was in my office one day, and he leaned in and said, you know, I've really never been as enamored of natural rights as you've been. I said, really, why is that? And as the conversation did its turn, it came to focus on that man in the gutter who had broken his own life. Say, why do we treat him as though he's a kind of bearer of rights? Something sacred about him. And my student did what could be called a kind of postmodernist song and dance. It was the culture and the lens by which we come to view him. And I said, whoa, time out. You're talking about us and our lens and how we view him. You stop talking about him. What I want to know, what is there about him that becomes the source of these rights you're talking about? And the second vignette came where I had a commission to do a piece for a magazine on the Holocaust Museum in Washington. And I came through there with a dear friend, Alan Greenberg, the architect. And we took a turn, we came upon a scene that's probably been encountered by people in here. A vast vat filled with shoes. These were the shoes of the victims that the Nazis thought they could sell or use again. And curiously, what came flashing back to me at that moment were those searing lines of Justice McLean in his dissenting opinion in the Dred Scott case, where he leaned in and said, you may think that black man is chattel, but he's a creature made in the image of his maker. He is amenable to the laws of God and man, and he is destined to, an endless existence. That is, he has a soul that will not decompose when his material existence comes to an end. I think we grasp the whole of the matter when we realize that the Nazis looked at this scene and they thought the shoes were the durables. Right? Now, I have colleagues back at Amherst who've taken as their signature tune that line from Nietzsche amplified by Dostoevsky, God is dead and everything is permitted. They are people of large liberal sympathies for the vast mankind, but even they have to concede that they cannot give the same account of the wrong of slavery or the wrong of the Holocaust that MacLean was in a position to give. And the last vignette I recall was a scene happening not far from my Amherst, Massachusetts, in Brookline years ago, after there was a shooting at the abortion clinic. And two nights later, there was a candlelight vigil. And one woman there with a candle and her newly born infant said, I'm here to protect for my child the same reproductive rights I've enjoyed, including the right to kill that child right up to and past the time of birth. We said, now that's really interesting. Those reproductive rights of the daughter, were they a species of natural rights? As James Wilson said, if we have natural rights, when do they begin? As soon as we begin to be. Which is why, he said, the law casts its protection over human beings from the first stirrings in the womb. If that infant daughter had borne reproductive rights, and they're species of natural rights, she had them when she began life as a female, which meant she had those rights when she was in the womb. And if she had those rights, her mother could have been authorized to have swept away those rights with a grand gesture in sweeping them away in a stroke by sweeping it away in a stroke, the bearer of those rights. That can't be the story. The story must be that those reproductive rights were conferred on the baby in a grand Nietzschean gesture where she said, I now confer upon you these rights because there's nothing about you that's inconsistent with my interests. Well, if that's the story of how we acquire these rights, notice they don't begin with any recognition of anything of intrinsic worth in the child herself that could become the source in turn of rights of intrinsic worth. These are rights conferred by the powerful as long as they serve the interests of the powerful, and they could be withdrawn at any time. So my point is, the point of my book, that anyone who chooses the right to choose cannot go along with the logic of natural rights, so that even if there is something called a right to abortion, it's been stripped of its moral logic. It would not stand on any higher plane than the right to use the squash courts at the college. It would not have at all the meaning that the apostles of abortion rights would impart to it. When I wrote my book, Natural Rights and the Right to Choose, I was feeling my frustration with George W. Bush and many old-line Republicans who kept shying away from the need to shape the public discourse by talking about this issue in public. The problem is still with us, and it's become even sharper of late, for the same people who feared talking about these issues are ever more spooked about the prospect that Republicans who speak about abortion will be accused of carrying on a war against women. And the same people tell us not to talk about same-sex marriage because we'll be labeled as bigots. The public has been very much on our side on these issues. And the evidence shows that these questions have been net winners for conservatives in our politics. And yet in the face of this evidence, some of the most seasoned hands among Republican consultants keep advising us not to talk about these issues that ordinary people truly care about and which run to the core. And so the lament I offered at the end of my book may still be apt, and I close with it now, because it still addresses a state of mind that saps and undermines the pro-life cause. And I put it in this way. I said, we have a political class that has somehow lost the conviction that the giving of reasons matters. A political class of this kind may serve in positions as offices of state, and yet its members will have lost their vocation. For at times, the need to clarify the principles entails the need to stage the confrontation or debate, and at times it requires the need to pick a fight. And a political class that's persistently reluctant to show that spirited nature will produce not merely a politics that is banal, but a politics, you might say, that is denatured. For in removing the conflict or removing the argument, we may be gently removing as well the moral substance. Now, Aristotle remarked in one of his most memorable observations in the Physics that if the art were in the materials, we'd expect to see ships growing out of trees. Right? But ships were not part of the world of causation produced through the operation of the laws of nature. Ships were part of a world governed by design, by the awareness of ends, by the shaping of reasons. My concern is that we may be bringing forth a political class now more and more detached from the sense that there's any particular importance in compelling the other side to come out with their reasons and claim them as their own. To a political class that is molding itself in that way, we may not only ask, where is the reason that gives meaning to political life, but where in all of that is the art? Where do we find the design that marked your understanding, the touch that reflected the experience you had cultivated? And where, finally, do we find the impression lasting through time that you were here? Thanks very much.
Absolutely for you. Sorry, I forgot my microphone.
Wow. That's, as we say, Amherst, you may have the wrong Reverend Jackson.
Actually, you can stand. I have my own microphone now.
Oh, okay.
Don't worry about my little book here.
There are questions?
Lots and lots of questions.
That means you did a good job. Confusing people. No, I'm just playing about that part, actually. They're brilliant questions. And we have a brilliant mind, so we're going to get the answers. The first question is of interest to me.
Brilliant mind is going to ask it.
Brilliant's asking, no, these are some very intellectual questions. And believe me, you better be prepared.
Who won the World Cup in 1965? He's like, okay.
It's not there.
Okay.
All right. Many here, though, have a representative are represented by a congresswoman who is completely on the left. Is it worthwhile to present the issue of penalties for those who kill infants born alive?
Oh, my goodness.
In this particular community.
Well, the point is, you point out, this bill was brought forth when the Senate was under Democratic control. We're surprised it was brought to the floor. Who brought it to the floor? Harry Reid. As majority whip, I suppose. And he brought it to the floor. No Democrat voted against it in the Senate. They had a voice vote. They wouldn't take a roll call. In the House, we had a roll call. Only two Republicans voted against it, Ben Gilman and Nancy Johnson from Connecticut. You could say, look, you people voted for it. 80% of the country think this is a reprehensible thing. You voted to say it was wrong. It's pertinent to ask you. What penalty do you think? And if you want to vote against the move to add the penalties for this act, to vote not to regard it as wrong, that is fine. Let's get that on the record. We gotta make sure we understand you. Let's get that down.
Do you know whether a congressman plans to introduce a Born Alive Infant Protection Act bill with penalties added, or
that's what I'm waiting for you to do.
Well,
okay,
our secret now has
no,
just
no,
gone no, live stream.
No, no, no. I've been I make my living, my day job is Amherst. Now I'm phasing out there and spending most of my time in Washington with our new James Wilson Institute. So I'm getting into gear with this again. So I'm trying to arrange a meeting with Trent Franks, who's chairman now of the Judiciary Committee. And we'll try to reach some of our friends on the Senate side as well to say, look, it's on the table. It's there. We passed this. And there are many other things we could do following this. I mean, I have a note from Karl Rove right after we passed this thing. And he said, God, that was so simple, so elegant. Do you have anything else? Are you kidding? We have a drawer full of things that we could do. But Mr. Bush was not – things that he could be done even without an executive order, right? There's so many I'll save that for another time. But, yes, I'll be busy trying to find the people to bring this down. People, just, I think, try not – they want to focus on Obamacare. They're afraid to create noise. But this one works for us. It works powerfully for us. All the evidence is that it works for us. And we'll find out who's capable of doing it. But I think there's an inclination. We have people on the Hill who are willing to do it. Okay. So I'll be at work on that.
Yeah, and I think you're pointing to a very significant point in an election year, that elections do matter. What we were referring to, my secret that is now out, is CURE is leading a delegation of pastors from our network to push the Congress to do something about the letters that they did send out. Congressman Franks sent out a letter to he's on Judiciary. He sent out to your AG, your Attorney General, and said, "What all across the country, every state got the letter. Show us what's happening in your clinics." Every state got a letter from Energy and Commerce that said, "Tell us." That letter was to the Department of Health. Tell us what's happening. Are there Gosnells in your community? And now they've shut down. And we are going to have them revisit those questions that they asked. There was a resolution in the Senate. And we want to know. And I'm glad that Hadley brought this up, because we discussed it at our table, that he's the missing component to us making sure that they open hearings. We are planning to have big black guys sitting outside of their doors, if we have to, with cameras, to make sure that they open these hearings.
The point to be made, I was talking with Phil Burris about that, my old ally from 20 years back, that...
We'll take big white guys like Phil Burris.
What?
Burris too. We'll take him, too. He's a pretty good guy.
Well, if you want to rate a pillbox, I look for Phil and Charlie Rice and a couple of other people. But it was the moving the bill at the national level that inspired the moves in the separate states. So sometimes taking a lead at the center will inspire things going on at the periphery. See, so it's not a loss to try to lead with it right here and lead with it in the Congress.
Absolutely.
And you have a terrific pro-life movement here, where my friend David Forte has been a consultant here. Many interesting things are going on in the State House here for the pro-life clause.
Interesting that you brought that up, because there is a question about state. So let me just grab that one real quick. I try to put them in some order. Okay, what is your opinion then on the state based personhood amendment? Would this be effective? Should we support it?
I'm dubious about it, because it simply gets us stuck. The other side resists by saying, it doesn't say person. You know, we can simply argue about what is a person, and I think the point is, you can. They'll have all kinds of clever. The original line was, we look in the text of the Constitution, covers people who are being extradited, moving from state to state. They must be postnatal. They may not have glasses either. We begin with the premises that that those beings we call human beings, moral agents, have the capacity to reason about their well-being. They have a claim to the protection of the law. You've got to give us the grounds on which you would remove any class of human beings from the circle of rights-bearing. Tell us what the criteria are. Okay, we have to do that, but somehow it doesn't get done within these states. I'd say we can go get much more mileage on focusing on the things we've already done. You've already told us. See, one of the points about this is we say, in the draft I wrote for the first George Bush, I'd had him say, the other side tells us that abortion is not infanticide, which means they're willing to protect the child at some point. Let's invite them to tell us when they're willing to protect their child. And if nothing else comes forth, why don't we suggest birth? You're not arguing anymore, are you? about the human standing of that person, right? That being. And its interests are quite detached from those of the mother. We're not arguing about those questions. Now the question is, what are the grounds on which you withdraw the protections of the law from a born child? That is quite clear. Their room for evasion is quite limited there. So let's look at the places where the room for evasion is limited.
We're going to get a few questions on that one, but I'll give them to you as they come up. With our 24-hour news cycle, et cetera, isn't the momentum for your proposal that would be gained by the Gosnell case, in fact, lost?
I'm sorry, I didn't. Good.
They're saying with all the media, they're going to move on. You know, isn't it lost, just the momentum for the proposal that would be gained by the Gosnell case?
It
won't get lost in the news cycle.
We bring it back. We bring it back. We allowed the moment to slip away, and now we're not allowing it because people have forgotten that we passed the bill that covered that. This is one of the effects of the media closing itself off to covering the bill. Remember the strategy of Jerry Nadler in the House to this feminist was, don't give them an argument, don't argue with them, just go along with it. Don't give them an argument that draws attention to the bill. And the media went along with that. We try to raise the temperature there by adding features to draw the argument, and still the media wouldn't cover it. Because the Republican so-called moderates in the House would not go along with us in putting these items in the bill. But we could bring it back. People have forgotten that we do have a bill that actually forbade that live birth abortion. Let's remind them. And remind them now we're simply going to be adding the penalties to a bill already enacted. It's a different moment.
Doesn't focusing only on restoring the penalties amount to too little? Doesn't it give the pro-choice groups too much ground?
How so? These people have, even people who are pro-choice have thought that Gosnell should be prosecuted. We have people who are pro-choice. I remember a gal from, I'm making a pitch for this at the law school at Duke years ago, and a gal from Planned Parenthood saying, gee, that sounds sensible to me. I think you should get a vote on that. I think this is the most disarming position. It's the hardest position for people who are pro-choice to resist.
Kind of put some, all right. Didn't the Supreme Court at the time of Roe v. Wade say that when we knew unequivocally when life began that the decision would have to be reconsidered? We know that scientifically now. Why aren't they reconsidering?
We knew scientifically then. I mean, we had ample information then. I mean, I remember being stirred myself by Paul Ramsey's great essay, you know, Chasing Back, when the child in the womb, when the palm pins, the fingerprint, when the child was swallowing or squinting, when local reflexes are there, finally tracing it all the way back to that zygotal dot, no larger than the period at the end of the sentence, and everything genetically we have now, genetically we had when we were that zygotal dot. And people should have enough high school biology to know that if any one of us was done in when we were that zygotal dot, we would have not have been the next pregnancy. That and that alone was us. I mean, we may have sonograms and other things we didn't have then, but there is nothing nothing that we need added to the science. It's not a matter of visuals. It's a matter of people. Look, over the years, if you permit us, I've been trying to explain to people, you know, we do Aquinas. That the divine law we know through revelation, but the natural law we know through that reasoning that is accessible to human beings as human beings. And we've taken as our model of principled reasoning that fragment that Lincoln wrote for himself, imagining himself engaged in a conversation with an owner of slaves, saying, why are you justified in making a slave of the black man? Is it because he's less intelligent than you? Now beware, the next white man who comes along, more intelligent than you, may rightly enslave you. Is it color, then, the lighter having the right to enslave that? I'll beware again, the next white man who comes along with a complexion lighter than yours may enslave you. Now, the upshot is there was nothing one could cite to disqualify the black man as a rights-bearing being that could not apply to many whites as well. This was simply principled argument. It was available to people across the religious division. It could be understood by Baptists, Catholics, backgammon players. Okay. And we simply used the same model of principled reasoning when it came to abortions. We'd say, why is that offspring in the womb less than human? Doesn't speak yet? Neither do deaf mutes. Doesn't have arms or legs? Other people lose arms or legs in the course of their lives without losing anything necessary to their standing as human beings to receive the protections of the law. There is nothing one could cite to disqualify the child in the womb that would not apply to many people walking about. Well, in other words, you don't have to be Catholic to understand this argument, and that has been precisely the teaching of the Church. This is not a matter of revelation of faith. It's a natural law argument composed of embryology and principled reasoning. Now, my point is, forgive the excursion, that those arguments were in place years ago. We had them. And the only difficulty here is people not facing up to them. I remember I heard of a conversation of Jim Buckley at dinner with Harry Blackmun not long after Roe versus Wade, and Jim was going through when the sole principle of bear went swallowing was going on. And Potter Stewart, is member of the Roe versus Wade court, saying, you're wrong. That's impossible. Never heard that. We've never had the argument presented to us very directly and forcefully in that way.
This is interesting. What could Nixon have done in response to Roe v. Wade if he were not embroiled in Watergate? No, they actually wrote that. He's a little pro-choice.
Every January 20th, we celebrate the anniversary of Jeff and Cindy O'Connell, my former student, who became the director, the CIA section chief in Beirut. I was down there for their wedding on January 20th, 1973, the day Mr. Nixon was inaugurated. And I got the news when I was on the train going back to Amherst when I stopped in Penn Station. In other words, it was the first business day after Mr. Nixon was inaugurated. We know now that Chief Justice Burger told Nixon this was coming, but we can hold it until after the election. See. So my sense is, David Eisenhower was a dear student of mine. He wrote his thesis with me. I knew David and Julie quite well, and I thought David and Julie were on my side, but I don't think Mr. Nixon would have expended much political capital to have helped us.
In fact, he's on record being exactly on the other side. All right, this was a little bit different subject. Why did Justice Roberts vote to allow Obamacare?
This is another friend of mine who's been expelled from our circle. My wife has a contract out on him. There are different people are furious. People are furious. You can see the tension feeding into personal relations among the families now too. People feel it because he made a shift at the very last moment when it became impossible for people on my side to frame the argument in meeting his argument. Some people, I think the best construction is that he feared that if the court struck it down, that Mr. Obama would wage the election on that basis. It was the mean Republicans in the most, a political vote with all the Republicans voting to strike it down and make the court into a direct political issue. On the other hand, he could have foreclosed much of the misery that we had here. So, we often incite that line of Justice Story's, what you may not do directly, you may not do indirectly. If it's wrong for you to kill Jones, it's wrong for you to hire someone to kill Jones. So when John tells us that, John Roberts told us that there's no way under the Commerce Clause that you can compel people to buy this product, but we'll do it indirectly by taxing people and offering to remit the money if they accept the penalty. By the way, I hope in the record we strike that part about the hip contract.
I don't know if they're doing much editing. We'll see.
John, John and the family are old friends. I don't want
okay.
to
yeah.
put out. Okay. Let's be delicate here, even if I'm not. Okay.
And if that question came from somebody that wasn't here last year, if you're looking for a deeper understanding as well, Hugh Hewitt approached it, if I recall. So you might want to get the tapes. It's one of the reasons that they spend so much energy and time in making sure that everything is available for you, because it is a question that many have. And I suppose you got on the hot seat on that one, knowing that you run in his circles and our friends there. I have another question here. We have truth on our side. Shouldn't we be drawing the line at zero, where life begins? Could it be hurting our credibility to promote legislation that only protects babies in later trimesters?
I have that in my talk. I excise it for the sake of saving time. It's a very interesting argument for us to take. I've seen Bill O'Reilly's favorite, late term abortion. That's interesting, but the point is, people out there could be very credulous, and we don't want to confirm the facile assumption that you become a human being only in the last trimester of a pregnancy. So that's why I would try to find other ways about it. Most people in the country thought that it was wrong to kill a child because it is afflicted with deafness. And they thought that would hold true regardless of the stage of gestation. In my own That surprised Mr. Roger Rosenblatt of New Republic. My own surmise was people thought it is wrong to kill anybody on grounds of deafness, and therefore it must be wrong at any age. I would try working through that route rather than giving people the easy assumption that, later in pregnancy, that's safely. These are all arguable, perfectly defensible points. They're not. And most of the abortions occur very early in the pregnancy, as we know.
It is clear that your strategy relies in part upon a plain reading of our Constitution, its historical interpretation, and the immutable powers of each branch of our government. Do you feel this strategy is difficult, or do you ever doubt it gives our current executive branch and part of our legislative branch, that does not believe our Constitution. What they're getting to is, come on, we have a whole lot of tyranny going on out there in Washington, D.C. Are you sure that we can get this done?
No, but the problem is it does not rely on a plain reading of the Constitution, because people just didn't think that there was an argument would arise over this. You have to go back to, people, the founders like James Wilson, his lectures on jurisprudence. If we hold that there are natural rights, that rights that apply, that attach themselves to human beings from their first moments, that it's wrong to rule human beings the way human beings rule dogs and horses. Their natural rights have flowed to them by nature. When does that begin? And therefore you understand that those protections attach to human beings at any level. You can't tell us that my standing as human being depends on my height, my weight, no. And the burden lies with those people who would explain to us why any offspring of human beings should be moved out of the circle of rights-bearing beings. Now, that's not made explicit in the Constitution. It just comes along with the very logic of the thing. But we have to recover that logic by recalling the way that first generation reasoned about these things. Yeah. As a help. It's not in the actual text.
So many questions and only time for one more. So the other good questions that I have, if you're going to be here,
yeah,
Hadley will be signing books as well.
There's only one book left.
Either way, you can ask your question then. We could only get to so many. But could you explain how a person who might have killed a pregnant woman and her child in the womb, how can they be convicted of two counts of murder, yet abortion is still permitted by the Supreme Court?
Yeah, we had Lindsey Graham, when he was in the House, had this bill on the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. I testified for Lindsey on that one, where you had a colonel, somebody in the Air Force, who kicked his wife, who was pregnant, killed a child, and they could prosecute only for the assault on the woman. So Lindsey brought the bill in to sort of recognize the wrong done to the child. So we have that. But this was an inconsistency that we've lived with for years. You know, we had a judge in Washington years ago incarcerating a pregnant woman because she had a heroin habit, And he incarcerated her lest she affect the child she was carrying with that habit. Now, she had the right to depend at any point her abortion to remove the very predicate on which she was being imprisoned. We've had this, the old argument used to be, how could the pregnant child have standing in an auto accident against a reckless driver and not against the surgeon out deliberately to take its life? We have lived with this inconsistency for years, and so some of us have tried to keep bringing this out in giving reasons. And ladies and gentlemen, may I say that that task of testing the reasons has become, for some of us, steady work.
Thank you.
Let me add one more thing. One of my funniest students years ago, Francis Xavier Basile, he's a doctor now, once wrote one of his papers, and he said, there's some people who take psychological distress as a ground for abortion. He says, there are many people who suffer psychological distress as a result of being exposed 3 days a week and 14 weeks a semester to the rapier-like wit and the fascist sexist ravings of their political science professor. He says, so is the cure to kill the professor? Obviously not. What do? You carry him through to the end of term. You wait until all the papers are in, and you give him up for adoption. Thank you.
You have been listening to Hadley Arks, the Edward N. Ney Professor of Jurisprudence and a member of the Amherst College faculty, presenting at the 2014 Bringing America Back to Life Symposium. This presentation was brought to you by Cleveland Right to Life, where through prayer, action, voting, and education, we are bringing America back to life.